Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. On today's program, we'll find out why the tiny pest that's causing big problems for area citrus growers is also a concern for homeowners as well. We'll find out why so many people are worried about the Asian citrus psyllid. We'll also continue our series into the launch of Obamacare and take a trip to a hospital in Madera County, where officials are preparing for the expansion of coverage and the uncertainty that it brings. Later in the program, we'll talk about Valley Firsts, a new exhibit at the Henry Mann Library at Fresno State that celebrates technological and intellectual achievement in Central California. That and much more coming up on Valley Edition. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Ezra Romero with these news headlines. The Kern County Board of Supervisors fired Kern Medical Center CEO Paul Hensler last night over concerns about financial mismanagement at the county-run hospital. Two big issues stood out: a budget deficit for the current fiscal year that tops $9 million, and the failure to develop a plan to repay the state for prior overpayment for services. An independent consultant and the hospital's new chief financial officer say they will continue to investigate the books of the medical center over the next 3 months. After nearly 2 weeks of sniping back and forth, California Governor Jerry Brown and Senate Leader Daryl Steinberg have reached a deal on their competing prison plans. Ben Adler has more from Sacramento on how the state will respond to the federal court order that requires California to reduce overcrowding in its prisons.
The agreement maintains Brown's original plan to increase capacity by leasing beds at county, private, and out-of-state facilities, but it also lays out an alternative. If the federal court alters its order, the state would put any savings into recidivism programs.
We'd rather find a combination plan that would achieve, I think, what the courts would like to achieve, but that can't be done by December 31st. We do need more time.
In a scene reminiscent of the Big Five budget talks of years past, the governor announced the deal outside his office door. He was flanked by legislative leaders from both parties, including Steinberg, the lone holdout from Brown's original proposal.
We all stand four square, I believe, behind the alternative, but we have the insurance that if the court does not modify the order, that we are protected, the public is protected, and we go with the original plan.
The deal brought a mixed response from the inmate's attorney, Don Spector. He says he'd rather the state spend money on recidivism programs than renting prison beds, but the latest plan is far too vague for him to support.
What we would want is to know how long of an extension they want, how much of the prison population would be reduced during that extension, how would they accomplish it, how could it be measured, and what's the likelihood it will occur.
Spector says he'll ask the court to reject the state's request to extend the deadline, and that would set up at least one more showdown with the three-judge panel that's come within inches of slapping the governor with contempt of court charges. And while no one would speculate as to how the judges would react to this carrot-and-stick approach, Brown did dangle a little teaser, saying the plan has been well-considered and well-consulted.
I think we have a reasonable chance. Just put it that way.
The legislature could vote on the deal as soon as Wednesday. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
Cattle rustling or crop raiding might seem like a relic of the Wild West, but in the San Joaquin Valley surrounding foothills, cattle theft is on the rise. So much so that it's inspired a new bill by a local legislator that would beef up fines for stealing livestock. The bill passed both through the Senate and the Assembly Friday with unanimous bipartisan support. The bill would establish a $5,000 fine for anyone convicted of livestock theft.
It has been a growing concern because with the increases in value that we've seen of recent times, people are stealing more.
That's Republican Assemblymember Frank Bigelow, who authored AB 924. And who himself is a cattle rancher in Madera County. The bill merges two sections of existing law focusing on living and dead livestock into one, and adds the fine. If the bill becomes law, the proceeds would go to the California Department of Food and Agriculture's Bureau of Livestock Identification, with the hopes of closing current livestock theft cases and preventing future theft.
This will help all livestock, whether you're a bunny, whether you're a goat producer, whether you've got a mule, a horse, sheep, lamb, hog, whatever. it will help all of those producers through the same mechanism.
Ryan Jacobson with the Fresno County Farm Bureau says the bill's unanimous approval was a feat for the ag industry. He says the loss of even one or two animals is a detriment to the rancher.
It doesn't take the crime of too many animals being stolen from an individual family that it makes a huge dent in their bottom line.
Justin Greer, a Valley rancher and president of the Tulare County Cattlemen's Association, says that AB 924 is a step in the right direction. He says Bigelow's support of the bill was crucial.
He's cognizant of the issues we're facing, so it's great to have one of our own, if you will, able to introduce a bill and champion it so we can make some real progress to help protect ourselves and our commodity.
Greer says that in 2012, cattle theft cost California ranchers around $1 million. He hopes that could drop if the bill becomes law. The bill now heads to Governor Brown for a signature. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Coming up in a few moments, we'll learn why California's $2 billion citrus industry is at risk and why the tree in your backyard could hold the key to its future. We'll also learn about how one local hospital is preparing to deal with the biggest change in our healthcare system in decades. But first, on Monday, the city of Fresno continued with its plan to clear the downtown area of homeless camps, dismantling the third homeless encampment in 3 weeks. Overall, the effort has displaced a total of about 250 people. City officials say the camps were a public health and safety problem, but FM89's Rebecca Plevin reports that many people who live there don't know where they'll go next.
On Monday morning, Pastor Ray Polk comforted a man who was packing up everything he owned.
You all right? I know. We gotta keep going forward.
Along H Street in downtown Fresno, the homeless were stuffing their possessions into plastic bags and shopping carts as city workers bulldozed and raked debris left behind. It's part of the city's efforts to rid Fresno of permanent homeless camps, which officials say are a health and safety threat. They say the goal is to connect people with housing and services. But Polk said he wouldn't take down the street church he constructed in the camp.
Well, they told me I would have to dismantle it myself. And if not, they will bulldoze it down. So I told them I couldn't do that. I couldn't define God like that and tear down something that God had me put up.
The church is made of white slats of wood. Polk has covered them in Proverbs and Bible verses. It's covered with a blue tarp and contains about 10 white plastic chairs.
If they make the decision, I would not, under any circumstances, take that down.
He also ran a food distribution from the church. Next to it, he constructed a memorial to the homeless who have died. There are flowers next to each makeshift headstone.
I figure I'd get a piece of wood, paint it white, put their names on it. At least they can come and pay tribute to a friend or a loved one, even if it's just once a year on Memorial Day.
City spokesman Mike Lukens said the memorial could remain, but that the church would be put into storage. It's not the first time that Polk and the homeless he serves have been displaced. But this time, Lukens says, the city has formed a task force to ensure that the camps don't reemerge.
We're making every effort, certainly much more than we have in the past, to make sure we're on top of making sure structures don't come back up and the encampments return.
He says the city is working with local agencies like the Housing Authority to find people homes. But 28-year-old Lena Richardson has no idea where she'll live now. She had lived in the camp for 6 months. Yesterday, she stood on the side of the road with her dog, Princess, in a shopping cart filled with her belongings.
My tent, my blankets, my battery, my solar panel so I can have electricity. That's about it.
She said she felt puzzled, confused, and sick.
What if they woke up the next day, they don't know where they're living, where they're going? That's depressing.
That's where Pastor Polk comes in. He says he'll still be there to provide spiritual support to the homeless.
I stay here and I make sure, comforting my brothers and sisters that, just hugging and embracing them while they cry. Try to uplift spirits like I always have done. And try to continue to give hope where hopelessness have failed,
Lukens says the city might demolish one more camp in the next 30 days. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Growers in the San Joaquin Valley are waging an all-out war to prevent the spread of a disease that infects trees and could decimate the state's citrus industry. The disease, known as Wanlong Bing, is carried by tiny insects. Those pests have already made their way to Tulare County and just last Friday were detected for the first time in the Kern County community of Wasco. FM 89's Ezra Romero reports on the preventative measures the California ag industry is taking to stop the disease from making its way into California's heartland and your own backyard.
Throughout Central California, those who work in the citrus industry are on edge. A tiny insect no larger than an aphid is threatening the future of the state's billion-dollar citrus crop. It's known as the Asian citrus psyllid.
It looks kind of like an aphid, only a little bit harder body, a little bit browner.
And the creature's babies are just as pleasant.
Nymphs are little yellowish things that sort of plaster themselves to the leaves and stems.
That was Beth Grafton Cardwell, an entomology specialist with the University of California at the Lynn Cove Research Center, just west of Visalia. The little bug packs a big punch. Just one bite into the leaves of a tree is all it takes for the insect to spread the bacteria that causes Wanlong Bing, a disease also known as HLB or citrus greening. It alters the production, appearance, and economic value of citrus trees, eventually killing them.
Wanlong Bing devastates the root system and the nutrition of the tree, and so early symptoms are yellowing of leaves, and then gradually the fruit becomes small and hard, and the juice tastes bitter, and eventually the tree dies.
HLB is considered to be one of the more serious threats to the citrus industry in the world, and at the moment, there is no cure. So far, the worst U.S. case of HLB has been in Florida, where over 32 counties have been infected. Since 2006, the disease has cost growers there over $3 billion and thousands of jobs. The psyllid was first detected in Southern California in 2008, and last year it made its way to Tulare County. Assemblymember Jim Patterson recently held a town hall meeting in Fresno to bring together state and local experts on the disease.
There's a huge issue at stake here, 10,000 jobs in California and $1.5 billion in crop value is at risk. And if we can keep the psyllid from turning into the tree disease, we'll avoid the problems that the state of Florida has run into. They now have 200,000 acres of diseased trees.
Since that town hall in late August, another county has been added to the list. Last week in the Kern County community of Wasco, one tiny psyllid was found in a backyard garden plastered to a piece of yellow sticky paper, known as a glassy wing sharpshooter trap. That's just weeks after six psyllids were found in Tulare County. In Wasco, Glenn Fankhauser, Assistant Director of Agriculture in Kern County, says even finding one psyllid shouldn't be taken lightly.
By itself, the psyllid isn't necessarily detrimental to the citrus industry in the state, as it would be if Wanlong Bing citrus greening were present in some trees. If we had both of them together, the psyllid is the vector that transmits it from tree to tree. That would be a problem if we had both of them together.
That is why the ag industry in California has launched a campaign to prevent the spread of the disease.
It's either them or us, so it's an all-out war. That's correct. If we don't stop the spread of the Asian citrus psyllid, and if we don't find Wanlong Bing before it finds the industry, we'll lose the California citrus industry.
That was Joel Nelson, president of California Citrus Mutual, a statewide trade association. He and others across the state want to keep California's $2 billion citrus industry free of the devastation that has plagued China, Florida, Mexico, and Brazil. Here's the good news. While the psyllid has been spotted in several counties, so far the bacterial HLB disease has only been found in one tree in the state. It made its way to California through what citrus experts say is per usual, a backyard citrus tree, this time in Southern California. The tree was quarantined and has since been pulled and is being analyzed. When a citrus psyllid is found in a sticky trap, officials set up a quarantine extending for 5 miles around the site. That means increased inspections and measures to prevent the pest from hitching a ride out of the zone, either on nursery trees or in leaves or twigs that can sometimes accompany freshly picked fruit. Some farmers are even taking the battle to the airwaves. Second-generation citrus grower Kevin Severns from Orange Cove, California, is the voice behind this public service announcement about the disease.
It's been called a death sentence for citrus, and it will kill the citrus trees in this grove, at my home, and in your yard, unless together we fight back.
He is the general manager of the Orange Cove Sanger Citrus Association.
Whenever you see your own grove, your own trees that you work hard to keep thriving, and realize that if this HLB takes hold, that that all could go downhill very quickly.
Severin says he's surprised how a creature so small can inflict so much damage.
A lot of times that's the way it is. It's not the things that we see and that are the most obvious that wind up being our biggest adversaries. It's the ones that are difficult to see and are insidious and just creep in slowly.
That is why he has joined a statewide movement to wipe out any psyllids that may make their way to Central California. While commercial growers are the most at risk, state officials say anyone with a backyard citrus tree needs to be aware of the issue.
It's not just a commercial citrus problem, it's a homeowner problem, because 60% of Californians have at least one citrus tree in their backyard.
The same officials say that education about the psyllid is crucial because the fate of the citrus industry is now in the hands of both farmers and residential gardeners.
The average layperson can just learn what a psyllid looks like and what Huanglongbing symptoms look like in a tree, so they can alert the authorities, especially if they're in the San Joaquin Valley where all of this is new.
The latest discovery of the psyllid in Kern County may be an indicator of what is to come for citrus in Central California. But farmers and ag advocates will put up a stiff fight before HLB becomes a reality in the region. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
And joining us now on the phone, we have Nick Hill. He's a citrus grower of Greenleaf Farms in Kingsburg and is also the chairman of the Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Program for the state. Nick, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me in.
Nick, is it realistic to think that growers and the state can stop this psyllid from spreading throughout the valley?
Yeah, I think it's very realistic that we, unlike any place in the world, have gotten in front of the disease. The growers have self-funded themselves and are spending millions and millions of dollars for detection. And in areas where the psyllid's found, eradication and suppression. So I think we have a very good chance, and I think we will beat this thing.
What sort of lessons have we learned from Florida?
We've learned exactly what I just got through saying, to get out in front of it, become proactive, set up your trappings within residential areas and within commercial areas, have a outreach campaign to the urban and also to the rural residents to let them know what we're doing and why we're doing it, why it's so important to save the backyard citrus tree as well as our industry.
Talk a little more about that. So many people in California, in regions like the Valley and in Southern California, have an orange tree or a lemon in their backyards, a grapefruit. That's a major concern, I imagine, because it's hard to monitor those, and in many cases, those, as I understand it, are where some of these pests can be found sometimes.
Yeah, most of the time, if not all of the time, the disease starts out in urban areas, so it was very important to us in the beginning of this to reach out to the urban residents and explain to them how devastating this disease is. In the Southern California Basin, there are more citrus trees in the backyard than there are in production orchards in the state of California. It gives you an idea of the scope of how many trees are down there. So we've gone to multi-language radio stations outputting messages about the disease and about the psyllid to go out and inspect your trees. If you see something that's it looks like a little aphid, call your local ag commissioner, have them come out and take a look. So the outreach program is as important as the suppression programs that we're talking about, because if we don't save the backyard citrus tree, we're not going to save our industry.
For people who are listening right now, maybe have some trees in their backyard, what should they look for? How can they start to detect and think if they have one of these?
Well, you could just go out and look at your tree. If you see some funny little aphid-looking bugs that are fluttering around, or you see something chewing on your tree that looks like a little worm or something, or what they call a nymph, you know, give your ag commissioner a call, Fresno County, Tulare, or Kern, wherever you happen to be. They'll be happy to come out and inspect the tree. There's a lot of traps that are set up in urban areas to pick up these things, but the trapping systems aren't as effective as just going out and visually looking.
Does the HLB disease spread from tree to tree other than the psyllid, or is that pretty much the only way it goes from tree to tree?
The only vector that HLB has is the Asian citrus psyllid. So that's why it's so important that we detect these little bugs immediately and get on them and get them eradicated in areas so that the disease is not transmitted. We've got a fighting chance here because it is the only vector for this disease.
And then when you find them, what do? You destroy the tree? Do you spray the whole area? Is there a pesticide that works on this? How do you approach it that way?
Well, in urban areas, CDFA, California Department of Agriculture, will come out to the areas and will meet with the local residents, and they'll have a program of treating the trees. both with foliar and with soil drench methods. And, you know, they'll come out, and we've had a very, very high rate of compliance in the L.A. and in San Diego and Imperial Valleys, up to less than 3% denial. So we feel good that if we go out to areas, CDFA has gone out, they have neighborhood, they'll go out to neighborhoods, they'll have the neighborhoods come in and they'll explain to them what they're doing, and they start a program out, and it's been very effective.
What about the quarantine that we hear that has been imposed in various areas in Kern County? Now the psyllid has been discovered in Kern County. How is that affecting growers and others in the area, nursery folks? What's changed? What does that mean? Does it mean you can't ship fruit out, or how does that work?
Well, they're still working on the parameters and the protocols for the quarantines in Tulare. And the one in Kern County, they're still doing what they call delimination, which means they're looking for more psyllids. They're inspecting areas around the finds, and they're also trapping, putting heavier trapping systems in. They're going to find out if this was just a single find or a multiple find. So right now, Kern County they're going through their due diligence to find out if there's a breeding population area. Tulare County, they're working towards what they call a spray and move program, which they can spray the trees a certain time before they pick them. That will knock or suppress or eradicate the psyllids, if there are any within the orchards. Then they'll have to tarp loads and then bring them out of the areas. But those final parameters or protocols have not been fully agreed upon yet. They're very close, but the growers are going to have to make several extra steps to get their products out of the quarantine area. Now, if they keep the products within the quarantine areas, and they can move freely to packing houses within the quarantine areas. But if they move fruit out, they've got to go through certain protocol steps.
There was a big article in the New York Times a few weeks ago about how growers in Florida and throughout the country are looking at different options, including genetically modified trees to try to battle this. Do you see that as being a realistic option for areas that already have HLB persistent?
Yeah, the science has come a long way in the past 4 years. I've been to Florida 3 times, and it's not pretty down there, but you know, between Florida, Texas, California, and USDA, we've done tens of millions of dollars into research. And they've, you know, genetically patterned these trees. They're figuring out how they can implant genes, splice genes, or just make a rootstock that's resistant. I think we're going to see a cure, you know, in the near future. The idea is to slow or completely stop the disease until those cures or those genetic pathways are found.
We certainly wish you the best. The citrus industry is a big part of the Valley. Nick Hill, our guest today on Valley Edition. He's a citrus grower with Greenleaf Farms in Kingsburg and is also chairman of the Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Program, joining us today on the telephone. Nick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Stay with us in just a moment. We'll be back and talk about how one local hospital is preparing for the implementation of Obamacare in just a few months. Folks will start signing up for coverage, and Madera Community Hospital is looking at its options. That's coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. A few weeks ago, we launched an ongoing series which looks at the expansion of coverage under the Affordable Care Act. We chose the community and county of Madera as our subject, and over the coming weeks, we'll look at how Obamacare is becoming a reality for all sectors of the community, from clinics to physicians, residents, and local businesses. In today's installment, FM 89's Rebecca Plevin takes a visit to Madera Community Hospital, the county's only hospital for adults, where officials are optimistic about the new law, despite great financial uncertainty.
If Madera Community Hospital is a safety net for county residents, then medical professionals like Stephanie Rolfo are a crucial link.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Stephanie. Nice to meet you.
The hospital has 106 beds and is the only adult acute care facility in the county. It also operates 3 clinics, like the one where Rolfo, a nurse practitioner, works.
You have your health net physical today, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, perfect. When's the last time you had a physical done?
The type of care offered at the hospital won't change much when the Affordable Care Act is implemented next January. But how that care is funded and reimbursed could change dramatically.
how many people really signed up. Now that they have insurance, are they going to seek out more services than they were in the past? Do we have the capacity to handle all of that? How are all the local physicians reacting to all this?
Mark Foote is the hospital's chief financial officer.
All those questions are yet to still be answered, and makes for an interesting time in healthcare with all the uncertainty that exists out there right now.
For the hospital, the big question is whether the books will balance once the health law is in place. Medicare payments to the hospital have already been reduced. The hospital receives federal payments for serving a disproportionate number of low-income patients, and these are slated to be chopped, too. The cuts could be offset if a significant number of the hospital's uninsured patients enroll in health insurance. But that's a big if, Foote says.
It's tough to decide right now whether the payments we're going to get from those previously uninsured patients that are mandated to buy coverage is going to be enough to offset the cuts that are coming through the Medicare program and other areas.
The balancing act will depend in part on how many uninsured people are successfully enrolled into new health insurance programs, like the expanded Medi-Cal program and the state's insurance exchange covered California.
Hopefully, if that is a great success, then the amount of people that pay for insurance themselves will be reduced, and thus we'll have fewer bad debts and other types of related non-payment situations, and that can make up for some of these cuts.
But based on Karen Polinelli's experience on the floor of the clinic, that could be a risky thing to bet on. She's a nurse practitioner and the director of the hospital's clinics.
I actually do talk to my patients about it, and they're in the dark. You know, they really have no clue about what's going to happen. Many of the patients don't even understand it.
And then there are undocumented patients who receive care at the hospital but aren't eligible for insurance under most provisions of the health law. Foote again.
There's never enough money to cover all the cost of those types of patients, so we have to absorb the costs above what we get paid for those patients and try to get covered by other forms of payments.
Madera Community Hospital is not facing these financial challenges alone. Jan Emerson Shea is with the California Hospital Association. She says hospitals in the state will take huge cuts, an estimated $17 billion between now and 2020, to help pay for the expanded coverage that the health law will provide. Meanwhile, she says, it could take several years for the uninsured to enroll in insurance.
It's a very challenging time for hospitals, exciting on one hand because we very much believe in the goals of the ACA. At the other hand, it's going to be very difficult because we are facing some very difficult financial times ahead with these payment cuts that are looming.
These cuts should not affect the quality of care provided in hospitals, but they could impact the types of services offered, Emerson Shea says.
Hospitals up and down the state are having to make difficult strategic decisions about what services they will be able to continue to offer their local communities and what services they may no longer be able to provide in order to keep their doors open.
Those decisions could be several years down the road, though. John Fry is the CEO of Madera Community Hospital. He says it will take time to determine the law's true impact on the hospital.
It is unprecedented change, and it just takes a lot of time for something so enormous to really determine if the results are what they thought they would be. But this is implemented over several years. This next year will be the most significant change to date, and then the next several years after that, we'll see the impact of that.
The hospital and its clinics will continue providing acute and preventative care to county residents. But how much that care will cost the hospital is an unknown and looming question. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Midwives have been delivering babies for most of human history. In modern times, midwives tending to home births have largely been marginalized from mainstream medicine. But a bill moving through the California legislature could foster stronger links between midwives and obstetricians. Healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone has more.
In Tosi Marceline's practice, prenatal checkups happen in the living room.
Okay, so first thing, I'm just going to get a little baseline.
Marceline is a home birth midwife. Today, her very pregnant client lies on the couch in her Sacramento home. Marceline kneels on the floor beside her. She takes out her battery-powered, handheld ultrasound machine and puts it on her client's belly.
Why don't you wiggle the baby a little bit, too?
Okay. They're doing a non-stress test on the baby. The mother gently nudges her belly so they can monitor the baby's heartbeat.
That's a good acceleration.
Tosi Marceline monitors pregnant ladies in their homes every day, and eventually she delivers their babies there too, dozens every year. She's been doing this for 30 years, and it shows through her calm assurance and her stories.
Your baby is fabulous.
My babies are movers.
Yeah. Here's what we know about human beings in general and babies.
Marceline's style of healthcare is very different from what you'd get in a doctor's office. Instead of a white coat, Marceline is dressed casually. She drives her Prius to her clients' homes so they don't have to wait in an office. Marceline will spend an hour with her clients, for whom she cares before, during, and after the baby's birth. Her client today, Shannon Keneally, had her first child in the hospital.
The experience in the hospital was very invasive. Like, I was trying to relax, and nurse would come in, and she'd flick on the lights and talk really loudly, and we're trying to talk soft and just so that I can relax.
Keneally chose to have her second child at home with Marceline as her midwife. No IV, and she wasn't hooked up to a monitor. She sewed before she gave birth in a giant tub of water. Keneally is having her third child at home, too.
I feel that birth is a natural thing, and they're trying to make it a hospital emergency every time.
But sometimes home births do become more urgent situations. Marceline says about 8% of her clients are transported to the hospital for a C-section or complications.
I still firmly feel that the best place for deliveries is in a hospital.
Dr. Ruth Haskins is a practicing obstetrician in Folsom.
We've got an operating room next door. When things unexpectedly go bad, we've got a hematologist down the hall. When a fever spikes and a rash breaks out, we've got an infectious disease specialist that can come take a look at her.
Haskin works with the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. She says planned home births that unexpectedly need hospital care can create complex medical situations.
And so now a physician doesn't have any information about the patient, doesn't have any input on the initial prenatal care that's so important, and suddenly is completely responsible for the outcome. That's the situation that we would like ultimately to remedy.
That situation is part of a decades-long history of non-collaboration and sometimes outright antagonism between home birth midwives and mainstream obstetricians. Current law says midwives should be supervised by a doctor, but in reality, physician liability insurance in California doesn't cover home births. One California lawmaker is trying to foster a better working relationship between the two groups.
I mean, the bill started as really just saying licensed midwives could go order tests and buy medical supplies they needed.
Democratic Assemblywoman Susan Bonilla is proposing to rewrite the law to allow midwives to attend normal pregnancies without physician supervision. But a doctor would be involved if a woman has certain risk factors.
My hope is that more and more women will really be able to experience birth with a midwife. And whether they choose to do it at home or in the hospital, I believe midwives have a passion and a commitment to the prenatal care process and to the labor and delivery process that's really excellent.
If passed, the bill may not resolve decades of differences between obstetricians and midwives, but it would be a baby step towards more collaboration. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Speaking of moms and newborns, does California have enough babies? New father and Zocalo Public Square, California editor Joe Matthews says no in his latest Connecting California column, which recently appeared on KVPR.org and in newspapers across the state. Joe joins us now on the telephone from Southern California. Joe, welcome to Valley Edition.
Great to be with you, Joe.
And congratulations on your new addition to your family, Sam.
Sam, yes, he's 12 days old.
Tell me a little more about what inspired this column. You're saying that California has there's a statewide interest in having a younger population, and the fact that our birth rate is slowing creates some big public policy problems.
Yeah, two things really. One is there was a terrific report early this year from University of Southern California demographer there named Dal Myers, who did some of the best work on California, that really struck me was, you know, obviously I knew birth rates were declining in California, but I didn't know that how low. We're now sort of, we're not quite at the European level of problem, but we're below, you know, 2.1 births per woman, which is the sort of the replacement rate. That's about the rate you need to sort of sustain your population level. We're down below two. People often try to talk about demographics or race in birth rates, but really the birth rate is falling among all kinds of Californians and all demographic groups, to the point where we actually lost, not a slower rate of growth, but lost. There are fewer children now than there were in 2000, almost 200,000 fewer children, and those numbers are continuing to decline. That's a big change, I mean, for this state. This is a state built on growth. It's always had more people. And, you know, we don't have the same migration from out of the country and from other states that we've had in the past that have given us growth. And that, you know, that's a big moment for a state like ours. And when you have, fewer children, as the Europeans have discovered, as some other advanced economies have discovered, that becomes a real issue and a real problem for future economic growth. I mean, and it means that what children are born, I now have, this is my third, bear a much bigger burden. They have to produce more economically, have a bigger social impact. I don't think California sort of understands this reality, and certainly we haven't even begun to reckon with it.
Now, for decades, we've heard concerns about overpopulation. We did a story on global warming the other day, and the first thing that popped up in my email from a listener saying, talk about overpopulation. That's the biggest problem facing us. That's why we have all these concerns about global warming and carbon footprints and things. Have fewer kids. That's the solution. How do you respond to something like that?
Well, you know, certainly I take climate change very seriously, and you know, consumption patterns in advanced economies, and California is certainly one. You know, people, all of us, consume more. So if you have more people and you change those consumption patterns, you don't change those consumption patterns, you've got more of a problem. But you know, shifting those consumption patterns, changing how we use energy, you know, becoming more efficient, those are things that cost a lot of money, and it's hard to have growth without people. Declining populations, places with declining populations, are not places that have a lot of economic growth. You really need to do both. I must say, I was partly inspired to write this piece because I found myself in the Bay Area. I'm from Los Angeles, with environmentally minded people who are giving me a hard time. This was before the child was born, about having a third child, and you know, I was struck by this sort of you know, you should have one child or none to save the planet. I'm not sure that really works, given you can't suspend the laws of economics, and it's going to cost a lot of money to change energy consumption, change other consumption patterns.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition, our guest today is Joe Matthews. He's the California editor for Zocalo Public Square, one of our partners here at Valley Public Radio. You can find Joe's Connecting California column quite regularly on our website, kvpr.org. And we're talking about one of his recent works that talks about California's slowing birth rate and the challenges it poses to the state. Joe, there's also people who say kids are a burden not only for economically for their parents, but also for the state itself, education, all of the other social services and things that the state has to provide. How does that calculus work out in your opinion? Do you see that differently?
Very much so. I mean, if you do a good job with children, if you educate them so that they become, you know, productive citizens, productive both economically and in other ways, they're a great value for the state, because particularly people who don't have children, don't have many children, you know, are not bearing the full costs of children. When you look at, you know, people complain about the taxes they're paying to cover this and that, but that's a tiny fraction of the cost of raising a child. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says for the Western United States that raising a child, you know, from that was born last year to the age of 18, they estimate that's $250,000. I put some my own figures for urban Southern California into the calculator, and it was closer to $500,000 for me. And the taxpayer support to my children, you know, even going to public schools and the like, is nowhere close to that. So essentially, I am investing in creating an economic asset that will benefit all the rest of you. I'm subsidizing you. So, you know, if you hear my kid, you know, scream too loud in the coffee shop or in the train, you know, don't give me a hard time. Remember, I'm producing this thing that's going to help you, and hopefully, you know, be a productive enough person that he can sort of, you know, buy your house from you when you're old or from your heirs when you're gone.
And you actually point to states like the UK and Singapore for examples of how government can incentivize childbearing.
Well, certainly, the places in there are a lot of countries, particularly advanced economies, that have low birth rates, even lower than ours, are creating all kinds of incentives for people to have children and to educate them. You know, Singapore, when I asked around, sort of is considered the leader in this. They essentially, for each of the first two children, you get $6,000, and essentially a savings account. Which can be used, the money in it can be used for education and child care and the like. And they're so interested in having more children that when they boost the number, it's $8,000 when you get to the third. That's obviously still a fraction of the cost of raising a child, but, you know, I do think California needs to have a conversation about where it's going to get more people from. You know, is immigration really the way that's going to happen? I think there are reasons to think we're never going to quite see a wave of immigration like we saw in the 1970s and 80s. So it would be nice to have more children, and we should probably do better by them and by their parents. Certainly, I might even have more children, but the cost is a big factor in not doing more of that. And actually, cost was the thing that scared me the most about having a third child.
Our guest today on Valley Edition is Joe Matthews. He's the California editor for Zocalo Public Square and the author of the Connecting California column that appears in newspapers across the state and on our website, kvpr.org. We're talking about his new column about California's slowing birth rate. Joe, congratulations again on your newborn son, Sam, and thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. As global concerns about climate change continue to grow, could it be that our basic human nature is part of the problem? In this segment of FM89's series of commentaries known as The Moral Is, Fresno State biology professor Madhusan Kattai suggests that our planet Earth will not accommodate our human frailties as much as we must adapt to its changing dynamics.
We humans are aggressively territorial, willing to defend what's ours against all comers. By no means the only territorial species, we are surely the most extreme. Animals mark territories to ensure access to crucial resources, food, shelter, mates. Many defend territories aggressively, risking injury or death to stave off challengers. We see this all around us, in the sweet bird song filling our gardens, male birds proclaiming dominion, and in our dogs marking their territories at every fence and lamppost. Even plants employ covert chemical warfare to prevent other plants from growing under their canopies, sucking their supply of water and nutrients. Yet no animal takes territoriality as far as humans. Most animals reserve their hostilities toward members of their own species. Scent marks, scratched tree trunks, vocal proclamations, these reinforce the shadow lines by which most animals defend resources for their exclusive use. Territories rarely pass on to progeny, who disperse away seeking their own homes. Boundaries are defended fiercely, but remain fluid and ever-changing, reflecting the dynamic geography of our planet. But humans take territoriality to whole new levels. We have not only sought to make our territories permanent, building fences and walls to keep intruders out, but we've also enshrined territoriality into elaborate systems of laws that regulate ownership and inheritance. Unlike any other species, we exhibit territoriality across large social hierarchies, from individual homes to clan and tribal domains to kingdoms and empires to modern nation-states. We even carve out and defend boundaries in the oceans and the air. Uniquely, we humans seek to control every element within our domains, extending our territoriality against all species. Whether it is ants in our kitchens, squirrels in our gardens, or species we label as aliens invading our national boundaries, we are at constant war against many a species, themselves eking out a living in the interstices of our rigidly demarcated landscapes. Our extreme territoriality flies in the face of a dynamic planet on whose surface hardly anything stays put, not even the very continents over which we wage epic and devastating wars. A key to evolutionary success on our dynamic planet is an ability to adapt to changing landscapes and a willingness to move with shifting habitats. Yet we have painted ourselves into Cartesian prisons, investing far too much in static territories built over ultimately ephemeral habitats. Rising seas threaten cities that we built for eternity. Sandstorms herald the march of deserts. Glaciers and polar ice sheets melt. Yet we cling to our cities and homes, unable to move, like deer frozen in the headlights of planetary change. If we are to ride the tides of climate change and other unpredictable events our planet throws at us, we must find ways to ease our attachment to rigid territories. We must soften our boundaries and allow other creatures and ourselves more room to share the resources of this pale blue dot. For the moral is, this is Madhusudan Katti.
And The Moral is a production of Valley Public Radio and Fresno State's Bonner Center for Character Education. And that's our regular commentary series. You can find more of those on our website at kvpr.org. Just look up The Moral Is. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and find out about a new exhibit that opens this Saturday at Fresno State's Henry Madden Library that celebrates Valley innovation in arts, culture, and technology. That's all coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition here on Valley Public Radio. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. A new exhibit at Fresno State's Henry Madden Library takes a fun look at the history of innovation in Central California. It's called Valley First, and it opens on Saturday, featuring everything from the Fresno Scraper to various cultural and intellectual achievements. Joining us now in the studio is Peter McDonald, the Dean of Library Services at Fresno State. Peter, welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me here. We're excited about this exhibition, and I think it's going to be a charmer for the whole Valley.
How did the idea for this exhibition come about?
Well, it really came about a couple of years ago when I felt that I'm a newbie to Fresno. I've only been here 6 years. And I began to realize how many magnificent things had come out of the Valley, both intellectual property, new discoveries, Supreme Court justices. And none of that story had ever been told. I couldn't find it in a single site, and slowly we began to think, why not put on an exhibition and make this something the whole Valley can enjoy?
And you wound up collaborating with some other individuals and other museums from across the Valley to help put this on. I know Jill Moffitt from the Historical Society was involved.
Absolutely. She's been a wonderful curator. All of the historical societies in the Valley have been great partners, but we've gone as far afield as the Bancroft Library at Berkeley, and University of the Pacific has been very generous. We've found partners with corporations, and it's just been a wonderful experience the last 5 or 6 months, just realizing how much pride there is in the Valley and how many wonderful objects and firsts there are.
So give us some examples. I know you have the Fresno Scraper in the library. You talk about the Caterpillar tractor, which originated here in the North Valley. You talk about innovations in Kern County and Bakersfield. So you're looking at a wide swath. What are some of the individual things that you're looking at?
Well, every single American who's of a certain age is going to have something called a credit card. That was launched in the Valley back in the late 50s by the Bank of America. So, and they chose Fresno because of its diversity. There was all sorts of cultural and ethnic diversity here, and they felt it's a town of right size, and it was launched here. So, and in the South Valley, you have the first combine harvester that was ever put together, basically in someone's backyard. But today you have the largest ag fair in the world in Tulare. So you can see a progression of how agriculture in the valley has grown from a backyard combine harvester to a show in Tulare that's second to none.
Now, it's also interesting that the Henry Mann Library is hosting this exhibit. It's not normally the thing that we think of when we think of a library. We think of a place to read books, to study, to gather information. But you've been very active not only in reaching out to the community and inviting folks from outside of the campus to visit your space and some of the great exhibits that you've had there, but you're almost taking an approach like a museum to some extent.
Absolutely. I mean, I think people forget that we're 8 acres of library. We have 1.4 million students come through our doors every year. We're a very vibrant, large, arguably the most beautiful library in California. And we have spaces, the Leon S. Peters Ellipse Gallery and the balcony that Pete Peters, for whom it's named, are second to none anywhere in the Valley, to my knowledge. The Fresno Art Museum does art, but we are in a position to do cultural shows, essentially filling the shoes that the Met used to do.
Yeah, and of course, for people who might be new to Fresno or aren't familiar with the story there, that's the former museum that was a vital part of the Valley's cultural scene for many years and unfortunately closed in the wake of the economic crisis in the country and expansion efforts. Talk about the importance from your perspective as an academic library being open to the community. That's something that I think a lot of people don't necessarily connect.
Well, the library is very much a community asset, and anybody can become a community member. I think it starts at $25. We're a tax-supported institution, so we're open to the public. The only downside is parking Monday through Friday. But weekends, we will be open, and we really consider ourselves an asset to the whole Fresno community. We have the best law collection. We have fabulous records and CDs, music scores, second to none children's collections. All of these are open and can be checked out by anybody in the county. So we really consider ourselves an asset to the community and welcoming to that community.
In a community such as ours in Central California, and this could go for just about any community here, we're so new. So much of what we have is new. There's so many people who are like yourself from out of the area who are transplants to this area. How important do you think it is to have something like this exhibit, to have something to tell the community narrative, the history of the community, and explain why it is that we are here and what makes us unique, what sets this part of the state apart from others, and maybe how does this fit into that?
Well, when I first came here, and I think everyone who's an outsider and moves to Fresno, what you hear is, oh my gosh, you're only an hour and a half from Yosemite or an hour from Kings County and only 3 from LA and San Francisco. And we forget that we ourselves are a fabulous destination. And when you hear that a Supreme Court judge, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, failed Latin, and we will show his report card in this exhibition and went on to become a Supreme Court justice, I think a community like ours that has so many challenges, and in education not least, that is a real beacon to any kid coming out of the valley to realize I could be that person. You know, maybe I failed something in grade school, but I can go on to great things. And really, this is all about putting that light, that the innovation and the people that have created so many wonderful inventions and firsts in the world grew up right here. They made this their home, and it's something for us to all be proud of.
Of course, you're mentioning former Chief Justice and former Governor of California, Earl Warren, who is
Absolutely.
From Kern County. This word that keeps coming up in our discussion today is innovation. And when we think of innovation today, most of us might think of, Silicon Valley and the Googles and Apples of the world, Tesla, those sorts of things. But this area has its own tradition of innovation, too.
Right. Well, I mean, for instance, the forests that could be harvested back in the 19th century were high in the hills, and building a road was much more difficult than building a flume. So, you know, when the great trees came down, how do you get them down to the Sanger Mill? Well, they innovated by creating a water flume, and the big logs would ride down these flumes for 62 miles, and there was even a period where for a nickel or something, you could straddle a log, and down you went. So,
safety precautions.
Yeah.
Today, thing.
Today you probably couldn't do it, but back then, ladies and bloomers would get on those logs and down they'd go. So it's quite fun. But it's just an example of, and we literally will have 200 plus examples of these sorts of things.
The exhibit opens on Saturday. It runs through?
December 15th. The good time to come if you're a community member are weekends. And we open at 10 on Saturdays and noon on Sundays. Please bring teenagers on up and bring your family. And you can certainly come during the week, but students get precedence on the parking. So.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, public transit is always an option for folks who want to make it out to the library as well and the university. Again, our guest today has been Peter McDonald. He is the Dean of Library Services at Fresno State. Fresno State's Henry Madden Library opens a new exhibit called Valley First, a look at everything unique about Central California, cultural innovation, technological achievement, and more. That's opening this Saturday at the library on campus. Peter, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That does it for this week's Valley Edition. Before we go, I want to share a listener letter. A few weeks ago, we aired our story about Farm to Fork and alternative farmers who are doing new things in the world of agriculture, young folks who are coming back to the Valley and bringing ideas from the big city to the farms. David from Fresno writes, "For a long time, I have maintained that the Central Valley should remind people that it's one of the most productive food processors in the world, producers in the world. Your guests were very good and made my point. You asked all of your guests the right questions. Thank you so much, David, for your comments. That's all for this Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, and reporter Rebecca Plevin, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.